and consists in the art of being honest. Only aim to do your duty, and mankind will give you credit where you fail. No longer persevere in sacrificing the rights of one part of the empire to the inordinate desires of another, but deal out to all equal and impartial right. This is the important post in which fortune has placed you, holding the balance of a great, if a well-poised, empire. And a claim of ultimate, if conditional, loyalty. It is neither our wish nor our interest to separate from Great Britain. Yet the demands were great. Still less let it be proposed that our properties within our own territories shall be taxed or regulated by any power on earth but our own. The God who gave us life gave us liberty at the same time. The hand of force may destroy, but cannot disjoin them. The author intended to carry the draft to Williamsburg himself. On the road, however, Jefferson was stricken with dysentery. Incapacitated, he sent his enslaved personal servant, Jupiter, to Williamsburg with two copies of the document, one for Peyton Randolph and the other for Patrick Henry. His words, now on their way into the hands of other men, he returned to Monticello. Thanks to Jupiter, Jefferson's paper reached Williamsburg. And thanks to Clementina Rind, the widow of William Rind, the printer with offices on North England Street, the piece was published, winning audiences in the rest of the colonies and in London. The assembled burgesses applauded when the summary view was read aloud at Peyton Randolph's house. To widen its reach, Mrs. Rind used her hand-pulled press to publish the summary view from the newspaper's offices in the Ludwell Paradise House in Williamsburg. In a preface, the printer wrote, "Without the knowledge of the author, we have ventured to communicate his sentiments to the public, who have certainly a right to know what the best and wisest of their members have thought on a subject in which they are so deeply interested." Either she or another editor chose a motto from Cicero to affix to the opening of the pamphlet. "It is the indispensable duty of the supreme magistrate to consider himself as acting for the whole community, and obliged to support its dignity and assign to the people, with justice, their various rights, as he would be faithful to the great trust reposed in him." On Saturday, August 6, 1774, George Washington paid 3 shillings 9 pence for several copies of what he called Mr. Jefferson's Bill of Rights. Thomas Walker, one of Jefferson's guardians from Peter Jefferson's will, loaned his to William Preston, a burgess and colonel of the militia, urging him to read the enclosed piece, and trusting that your care of it I can depend on, as I have no other copy. The summary view framed the issue starkly, too starkly for some at that hour. However far the mind might range in the direction of independence and war, thinking about the intellectual justifications for revolution and taking up arms were very different things. Tamer sentiments were preferred, and I believe wisely preferred, the leap I proposed being too long as yet for the mass of our citizens. In the Virginia of the time there was, he said, an inequality of pace among the people, and prudence was required to keep front and rear together. With the summary view, Jefferson moved toward the front ranks of the cause, taking an advanced position. There were even rumors that Jefferson had been added to a bill of attainder in London, which would have declared him guilty, presumably of treason, a capital offense. In the day of fasting and prayer resolution, the Albemarle resolves, and the summary view, Jefferson had appealed to his audience's sense of justice, which one would expect in the litigation of grievances, but also to its sense of destiny. In his rhetoric, he deployed both the particular and the universal. He simultaneously made the most specific of allegations of British wrongdoing, some of which were obscure even to contemporary readers and listeners, and sketched out a vision of history in which the struggles of the hour were indelible chapters in the long story of freedom. In so doing, Jefferson mastered the art of rhetorical political leadership by appearing at once concerned about the needs of his people and attentive to their innate need to be part of a larger drama that imbues daily life with mythic stakes. The work of his conscious life had been the accumulation of knowledge, the broadening of his mind, and the formation of ideas about liberty, law, and how one ought to live. Under William Small, under George Wythe, alongside Dabney Carr and John Page, Jefferson had come to believe that reason, not hereditary right, should govern human affairs. Tyranny was tyranny, whether practiced by kings or priests. He knew, too, that he was risking everything, and everything of his young families. In his commonplace book, he had copied down these lines from Pope's translation of Homer. "Death is the worst, a fate which all must try, and for our country 'tis a bliss to die. The gallant man, though slain in fight he be, yet leaves his nation safe, his children free, entails a debt on all the grateful state. His own brave friends shall glory in his fate. His wife live honored, all his race succeed, and late posterity enjoy the deed." America was still 23 months from declaring independence when Thomas Jefferson gave the Atlantic world the summary view. His celebrity grew as his pamphlet circulated. John Adams thought it a very handsome public paper that demonstrated a happy talent for composition. Because of the play of his mind and the formation of his convictions, Jefferson was something of a prophet in the summer and fall of 1774, a figure who, from a mountaintop, looked deep into the nature of things and told his countrymen what he had seen. The summary view was an act of courage driven by conviction offered to a people in search of a creed. As 1774 drew to a close, Jefferson, at 31 years old, a husband, father, lawyer, planter, legislator, and thinker, had moved to a new, higher rank of political skill. The summary view and his other pieces demonstrated a capacity to reflect and advance the sentiments of his public simultaneously, giving his audience both a vision of the future and a concrete sense that he knew how to bring the distant closer to hand, and dreams closer to reality. Chapter 7. There is no peace. Blows must decide whether they are to be subject to this country or independent. King George III on the American colonies. At Monticello, the peach trees were blossoming. It was early March 1775, and Jefferson was preparing to leave for Richmond to attend the Virginia Convention, a meeting of revolutionary leaders to be held at St. John's, a hilltop wooden Anglican church. The building was the largest structure in Richmond, and every bit of space was needed. Organizers expected 100 or so delegates to make their way to St. John's through the springtime mud. The president of the convention sat behind the communion rail. Delegates filled the pews, and eager spectators took up the remaining seating. The overflow from the daily crowds stood outside the open windows in the walled churchyard, listening. The work of the convention was intense, Jefferson's range of tasks wide. Virginia's revolutionary leaders had to make decisions about military preparations, taxes, and trade, formulating policy in the expectation of war, while British officials in the colony were themselves taking a stronger stand against Jefferson and his colleagues. John Murray, 4th Earl of Dunmore, the tough-minded Scottish-born royal governor who had succeeded Beautetour, had forbidden Virginians to import arms and powder from Britain. London had also ordered the seizure of any munitions that arrived in America, stipulating that the royal representatives were to prevent elections to the Second Continental Congress. Neither side showed any inclination to back down. At St. John's, Jefferson threw himself into whatever came his way. He was hard-headed, not theoretical. He believed the hour called for action, not rhetoric. On March 23, 1775, a springtime Thursday warm enough for the windows of the church to be left open, Patrick Henry called on Virginia to move its militia into a posture of defense. Standing in pew 47 in the eastern aisle of the nave of the church, Henry spoke brilliantly. "Gentlemen may cry, 'Peace, peace,' but there is no peace," Henry said. "The war is actually begun." In a transporting climax, Henry cried, "I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty or give me death." To Jefferson, Henry was essentially a magician. His eloquence was peculiar, if indeed it should be called eloquence, for it was impressive and sublime beyond what can be imagined, Jefferson later said. Although it was difficult when he had spoken to tell what he had said, yet while he was speaking, it always seemed directly to the point. Afterward, it fell to a committee that included Jefferson to work out the actual plans for colonial defense. The committee resolved that each troop of horse consist of 30 exclusive of officers, that every horseman be provided with a good horse, bridle, saddle, with pistols and holsters, a carbine or other short firelock with a bucket, a cutting sword or tomahawk, 1 pound of gunpowder and 4 pound of ball at the least, and use the utmost diligence in training and accustoming his horse to stand the discharge of firearms, and in making himself acquainted with the military exercise for cavalry. There were possible fissures within the colonies. New York had reportedly voted against electing representatives to the Second Continental Congress, scheduled for May. Did that decision, Jefferson asked, mean New York had deserted the Union? Weapons, militiamen, unity. In Richmond, Jefferson was at work in the cause of defense. Away from his committee duties and the action on the floor, he tried to enjoy himself in Richmond, drinking at Mrs. Younghusband's tavern, dining at Gunn's rival establishment, and buying book muslin for his library from Mrs. Ogilvy. The next political act, however, was already scheduled. On Monday, March 27, 1775, Jefferson was elected as a deputy to the Second Continental Congress. The first Congress had been called in the wake of the Boston Port Act and the other so-called coercive acts. Gathering from September to October 1774, shortly after Jefferson wrote the summary view, then fell ill, the Congress had issued a list of grievances against the British government, called for a continued boycott of British goods, as well as enforcement of that boycott, and agreed to meet again if necessary. And necessary it was. The threat of war seemed to grow in the autumn of 1774. In New England, British troops took control of powder magazines and cannons to secure them from colonial militias, and asked London for more troops in expectations that bloodshed was at hand. London's response to this request, and to the First Continental Congress, was to offer the British military commander in North America, General Thomas Gage, a clear instruction. Force, the government advised Gage, should be repelled by force. There was to be no negotiation. There was to be war. The Second Continental Congress was, therefore, to take on an even more daunting task than the first, the management of an aspiring nation undertaking an armed revolution. In Richmond, Jefferson's committee's resolution on preparing the militia noted that a failure to prepare militarily would leave Virginia in evident danger in case of invasion or insurrection. Both possibilities, invasion from without or insurrection from within, felt more likely after the third week of April 1775. In Massachusetts, British troops and American colonists clashed at Lexington and Concord on Wednesday, April 19, 1775. By the end of the day, after gunfire along a shifting 16-mile front, there were 273 British and 95 American casualties. The exact sequence of the battle is unclear, but the meaning of the bloodshed was unmistakable. As Jefferson wrote after hearing the reports, any last hopes of reconciliation were now gone. A frenzy of revenge, he added, seems to have seized all ranks of people. The painter John Singleton Copley wrote his half-brother, "The flame of civil war is now broke out in America, and I have not the least doubt it will rage with a violence equal to what it has ever done in any other country at any time." In Virginia, elite whites were contending with slave violence, both rumored and real, and with the seizure by Lord Dunmore of the supplies of gunpowder at Williamsburg. In the middle of April, in Chesterfield County, not far from Albemarle, whites were alarmed for an insurrection of the slaves. In Northumberland County, two slaves set fire to a militia officer's house with a parcel of straw fixed to the end of a pole. Dunmore decided that the enemy of his enemy was his friend, that the slaves whom the whites often feared were Britain's natural allies in Virginia. As Thursday, April 20, 1775, became Friday, April 21, Royal Marines removed 15 half-barrels of gunpowder from the public magazine at Williamsburg to the HMS Magdalen, effectively disarming the Virginians. A furious crowd of colonists gathered outside the governor's palace, ready for anything. At the palace, Dunmore announced that he was simply securing the powder in the event of a slave insurrection. But the royal governor barely concealed his fury and contempt, later calling the crowd one of the highest insults that could be offered to the authority of His Majesty's government. Dunmore was especially angry about the presence of militia in Williamsburg, noting that the colonists were treating with him under the muskets of their independent company, which they left only at a little distance from my house. 2 days later, Dunmore arrested two of the company's leaders. It was then that he truly struck. On Saturday, April 22, 1775, Dunmore announced that, by the living God, he would declare freedom to the slaves and reduce the city of Williamsburg to ashes, should there be further injury or insult to the royal establishment. Reaction was swift and predictable. From Pennsylvania, a colonist wrote a friend overseas, "Hell itself could not have vomited anything more black than his design of emancipating our slaves." Colonists with slaveholding sympathies either began or accelerated their preparations for war, Jefferson among them. Jefferson was obsessed with politics of the Continental Crisis. In a Sunday, May 7, 1775 letter to his old teacher William Small in England, Jefferson interrupted himself at one point to say, "But for God's sake, where am I got to? Forever absorbed in the distresses of my country, I cannot, for three sentences, keep clear of its political struggles." Yet he could not help himself. "Within this week," he wrote to Small, "we have received the unhappy news of an action of considerable magnitude between the king's troops and our brethren of Boston." The fact that blood was shed under such circumstances, Jefferson said, seemed to doom prospects for a peaceful resolution. Small died in Birmingham, England, before Jefferson's letter reached him. Dunmore's seizure of the gunpowder and his statements about the slaves inflamed matters in Jefferson's immediate world. In Albemarle County, the militia declared they wanted to demand satisfaction of Dunmore for the powder, and his threatening to fix his standard and call over the Negroes. To Jefferson, Dunmore was the particular manifestation of a universal truth. The British were unbending, apparently uninterested in even affecting an air of respect toward the Americans. The bolder the Americans grew, the surlier the British seemed. Ever sensitive to slights, and conscious of the alchemy of human relationships, in which respect, rivalry, affection, and deference were bound together in varying and changing proportions, Jefferson was able to detect such shifts in the political realm, as well as in his personal one. He offered an astute analysis of the British approach. "A little knowledge of human nature and attention to its ordinary workings might have foreseen that the spirits of the people here were in a state in which they were more likely to be provoked than frightened by haughty deportment." Jefferson's political education continued during a spirited session when the House of Burgesses met in Williamsburg in June 1775. While the House considered conciliatory proposals from London, three Virginia colonists trying to break into the powder magazine were wounded by a shotgun rigged to fire if the magazine were tampered with. Dunmore felt the situation so precarious and his security so tenuous that he and his family left Williamsburg seeking refuge aboard the HMS Foy. Around Saturday, June 10, 1775, Jefferson replied to London's conciliatory proposal on behalf of Virginia. Despite the passions of the hour, a fleeing royal governor, skirmishes over gunpowder, and the fear of slave rebellion, Jefferson took a measured tone, saying that the Virginians had examined it minutely, reviewed it in every point of light in which we were able to place it, and with pain and disappointment we must ultimately declare it only changes the form of oppression without lightening its burden. Others in Virginia were not so certain. As Jefferson recalled it, Robert Carter Nicholas and James Mercer, a lawyer from Stafford County, were more open to talk of reconciliation with London than was either Jefferson or, more important, Peyton Randolph, who believed Virginia should take a stronger revolutionary stance. In a sign of his standing with Peyton Randolph, Jefferson was asked to draft the House's response, for Randolph feared that Mr. Nicholas, whose mind was not yet up to the mark of the times, would undertake the answer. With Jefferson's text as the starting point, Randolph was able to exert a greater level of control than if Nicholas had been the initial author. It was still a contentious argument. Even after the Boston Tea Party, even after Lexington and Concord, even after Dunmore and the gunpowder affair and the talk of arming slaves, a permanent separation from Great Britain was a matter of intense debate for Jefferson and his contemporaries. Divided opinion was a recurring fact of life for Jefferson in these years of political formation. He came of age amid conflict, not certitude. To him, statecraft was always a struggle between passionately held points of view. Smooth marches of like minds to glorious conclusions may have been the stuff of his dreams, but reality was far different, and it was reality that concerned him most. Randolph shepherded Jefferson's draft through the assembly. There were, Jefferson said, long and doubtful scruples from Mr. Nicholas and James Mercer, and a dash of cold water on it here and there, enfeebling it somewhat. But it finally passed. For Jefferson and Randolph, the key point was unity among the colonies. Such unity was on Jefferson's mind, for he was to take his place on the national stage at last. He left Williamsburg for the Second Continental Congress in Philadelphia on Sunday, June 11, 1775. A larger world beckoned. Chapter 8. The Famous Mr. Jefferson. As our enemies have found, we can reason like men. So now let us show them we can fight like men also. Thomas Jefferson, July 5, 1775. The present crisis is so full of danger and uncertainty that opinions here are various. Thomas Jefferson from Philadelphia, 1775. Lodging on Chestnut between 3rd and 4th Streets in Philadelphia, where the Continental Congress was meeting at the Pennsylvania State House, later known as Independence Hall, Jefferson effortlessly entered the flow of things. He sent accounts of the military situation to Virginia. He looked over Benjamin Franklin's proposal for Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union. He recorded the financial and military estimates for Continental defense. In a way, he had been preparing for this hour and for this work since he first stood in the lobby of the House of Burgesses in Williamsburg, listening, rapt, to Patrick Henry a decade before. There had been the glittering evenings at Fouquier's palace, full of music and ideas, the golden years in the Wythe House, immersed in law and history, the apprenticeship in politics under Peyton Randolph in the Raleigh Tavern, watching and learning. The Jefferson style, cultivate his elders, make himself pleasant to his contemporaries, and use his pen and his intelligence to shape the debate, armed him well for the national arena. He was no longer in Williamsburg or Richmond, but he felt at home. In Virginia, Jefferson had known everything and everyone. In sessions of the Congress in Philadelphia and in hours of walking the city, he encountered new ideas, new people, new forces. Philadelphians, said the Anglican clergyman William Smith, were a people thrown together from various quarters of the world, differing in all things, language, manners, and sentiment. Another clergyman, Jacob Duché, said, the poorest laborer upon the shore of the Delaware thinks himself entitled to deliver his sentiments in matters of religion and politics with as much freedom as the gentleman or the scholar, for every man expects one day or another to be upon a footing with his wealthiest neighbor. In Philadelphia, Jefferson was caught up in a whirlwind of war and the rumors of war. John Adams of Massachusetts had proposed the appointment of George Washington of Virginia as commanding general for the Continental forces, a choice the Congress approved on Thursday, June 15, 1775. 2 days later came the battle at Bunker Hill in Boston. What Jefferson had heard Patrick Henry assert in the nave of St. John's Church, 250 miles south of Philadelphia in March, was now fact. There was no peace. Jefferson's arrival in Philadelphia was an occasion of note among the delegates. Samuel Ward of Rhode Island recorded seeing the famous Mr. Jefferson and the said Virginian looks like a very sensible, spirited, fine fellow, and by the pamphlet which he wrote last summer, The Summary View, he certainly is one. Later in the year, John Adams reported a fellow delegate's view that Jefferson is the greatest rubber-off of dust that he has ever met with, that he has learned French, Italian, Spanish, and wants to learn German. Adams and Jefferson could hardly have appeared less alike. Adams was 8 years older and about 5 inches shorter, as thoroughgoing a New Englander as Jefferson was a Virginian. Adams had difficulty holding his tongue or his temper. Jefferson was a master of keeping his emotions in check. Yet the two men, and in time Abigail, Adams's wonderful wife, were to forge one of the greatest and most complicated alliances in American history. Born in Braintree, Massachusetts, in 1735, John Adams was the son of a farmer and public servant. Like Peter Jefferson, John Adams Sr. loomed large to his son. Young Adams was educated at Harvard, considered but decided against becoming a congregational minister, and made his mark as a lawyer in Boston in the tumultuous years leading to the American Revolution. From 1775 until the politics of the first Washington administration drove them apart, Adams and Jefferson worked together often and well, particularly in their years as fellow American diplomats in Europe. Their falling out over the direction of the nation in the 1790s and the first decade or so of the 19th century was profound, for their disagreements were deep. Yet, after both men retired, they would revive the friendship they formed in these early Philadelphia days. "I consider you and him as the North and South Poles of the American Revolution," their fellow revolutionary Benjamin Rush wrote Adams in February 1812. "Some talked, some wrote, and some fought to promote and establish it. But you and Mr. Jefferson thought for us all." Jefferson's proximity to the action and his new connection to delegates from the northern colonies, particularly Adams, grew into an intense admiration for New England. To read of valor is one thing. To live among those who are following the news of bloodshed in their homes, who have a direct stake in the outcome, is to experience conflict at a more fundamental level. The ethos of war was all around him. 1 week after Jefferson came to the city, the Congress authorized an invasion of Canada, a dramatic move that helped fix Canada's place firmly in Jefferson's political and military imaginations. Since the end of the French and Indian War in 1763, the British had occupied large sections of Canada, once known as New France. In the face of American invasion in 1775, Montreal surrendered, but Quebec held out. The failure to conquer the whole territory effectively left it in British hands, and Canada became a haven for loyalists. After the war, Canada was, in the American mind, a possible staging ground for a reassertion of British force and influence in the new United States. Jefferson found an infectious courage in Philadelphia in 1775. "Nobody now entertains a doubt but that we are able to cope with the whole force of Great Britain, if we are but willing to exert ourselves," he wrote in July. They were high hopes. But Jefferson was in a noble frame of mind, believing the Americans capable of vigor and virtue. Jefferson and John Dickinson, the author of Letters from a Farmer in Pennsylvania, consulted in these weeks at Dickinson's Fairhill estate outside Philadelphia on the Germantown Road. The result? A declaration of the causes and necessity for taking up arms, which was adopted by the Congress on Thursday, July 6, 1775. The next day, Jefferson slipped away from the Congress and rode the ferry to the Woodlands, the botanist William Hamilton's estate on the Schuylkill River. Hamilton and Jefferson shared a passion for landscape gardening. Walking the woodlands on this summer's day, Jefferson was likely imaginatively engaged by visions of creation, of bringing the natural world into harmony with the human. He also made a trip to the falls of the Schuylkill for an outing and dinner. Such excursions offered welcome, if brief, respites from politics and from war. On Saturday, July 8, 1775, having made the case for armed resistance with Dickinson and Jefferson's declaration of causes, the Congress extended its hand to the king, dispatching an olive branch petition to London. Nothing came of it. Jefferson rarely spoke in large assemblies, preferring to make his mark in different ways. As accomplished a student of politics and of history as John Adams, believed Jefferson benefited enormously from holding his tongue in debate. From all that Adams had read and all that he had experienced firsthand, he had learned, he said, "Eloquence in public assemblies is not the surest road to fame and preferment, at least unless it be used with great caution, very rarely, and with great reserve." Classing Jefferson with George Washington and Benjamin Franklin, both of whom were also reluctant to speak at length in public, Adams said, "A public speaker who inserts himself or is urged by others into the conduct of affairs by daily exertions to justify his measures and answer the objections of opponents makes himself too familiar with the public and unavoidably makes himself enemies. To write public papers or to negotiate quietly away from the floor of an assembly or even away from a largish committee enabled a politician to exert his will with less risk of creating animosity. Few persons can bear to be outdone in reasoning or declamation or wit or sarcasm or repartee or satire. And all these things are very apt to grow out of public debate," said Adams. "In this way, in the course of years, a nation becomes full of a man's enemies, or at least of such as have been galled in some controversy, and take a secret pleasure in assisting to humble and mortify him." Jefferson was reflective, yet practical, confident, yet realistic, in the middle of the maelstrom of 1775. The continuance and the extent of this conflict we consider as among the secrets of Providence, but we also reflect on the propriety of being prepared for the worst events, and, so far as human foresight can provide, to be guarded against probable evils, at least, he said. "Perhaps a few gentlemen of genius and spirit should be sent to train under General Washington to learn the necessary art of war." So much was unknowable. But the political language of war had to celebrate what had been done and offer hope for darker moments. Jefferson was mastering this complex vocabulary. He knew, clearly, that Virginia faced a deficiency of military skill, a skill that, in these days of rapine, can only be relied upon for public safety. The use of rapine came from the lawyer in Jefferson. It was an ancient legal term for violent seizure of property, a rhetorical touch underscoring the view that anyone with property had a stake in the struggle. After a visit to Robert Bell's shop on 3rd Street to buy a copy of James Berg's book, Political Disquisitions, Jefferson left Philadelphia for Virginia on Tuesday, August 1st, 1775. He stopped along the road at Mrs. Clay's Inn at Newcastle, Delaware, then continued onward to Chestertown, Annapolis, and Port Royal, en route home to Monticello. In the absence of any surviving letters between Jefferson and his wife, the assumption is that he destroyed their correspondence in the interests of privacy, we can only guess about the tone they used with each other when apart. Given Jefferson's letters to his family and friends throughout his life, though, it is likely that he wrote to Patty in rather the way his contemporary Theodoric Bland, Jr. wrote his own wife. Bland was a Virginian, a physician, a politician, and a revolutionary. Writing his wife, also named Martha, from the front in New Jersey in 1777, Bland said, "For God's sake, my dear, when you are writing, write of nothing but yourself, or at least exhaust that dear, ever dear subject before you make a transition to another. Tell me of your going to bed, of your rising, of the hour you breakfast, dine, sup, visit. Tell me of anything, but leave me not in doubt about your health. Fear not. Yes, you will again feel your husband's lips flowing with love and affectionate warmth. Heaven never means to separate two who love so well, so soon. And if it does, with what transport shall we meet in heaven?" With Patty, Jefferson had built the kind of marriage and life he wanted on the mountain. Music and dancing were essential. Jefferson never stopped humming, ordered an Aeolian harp, and paid £5 for a new violin. In memory, he could hear his sister Jane's voice singing, and in the moment he could sit and listen to Patty play the pianoforte or the harpsichord. "Mrs. Jefferson was small," said the slave, Isaac Granger Jefferson, "and pretty. She was also busy. both bearing children and presiding over the plantation during her husband's absences. Her account book tracks her daily work, including supervising the slaughter of ducks, turkeys, hogs, sheep, and lambs. She also managed the slaves in the house. The first Monticello, Jefferson eventually tore down the house and started anew in the 1790s, was smaller than the second and final version, but it was still a grand place. The house was built quite recently in the latest Italian style, a visitor wrote of the first Monticello. There is a colonnade around the structure, and the frieze is very charmingly decorated with all kinds of sculptures drawn from mythology. He acquired a chessboard in pieces, a backgammon table, a refracting telescope, 8 Venetian blinds, and Scotch carpet. He was always on the watch for lovely things, and always, always, books. Even the first Monticello had, a visitor noted, a copious and well-chosen library. The house itself, an elegant building, the visitor recalled, was only the most vivid expression of Jefferson's wide-ranging mind. From books, to languages, to music, to entertaining, to art, to architecture, he was constantly learning, experiencing, experimenting, tasting, living. At Shadwell and at the Governor's Palace in Williamsburg, he had been taught that there was a vast world to engage and shape. His architectural sense was informed by, among other works, James Gibbs' Rules for Drawing the Several Parts of Architecture, and an edition of The Architecture of A. Palladio. He mused on the painting scheme for his dining room, ordered a copy of Hannah Glass's Art of Cookery Made Plain and Easy, and sent for a clothes press. Jefferson had joined the Philosophical Society for the Advancement of Useful Knowledge, founded by Virginians, including his friend John Page, on the model of the American Philosophical Society, to which Jefferson was elected in 1780. In 1772, James McClurg, the future director of hospitals for Virginia during the Revolutionary War, published a book entitled Experiments Upon the Human Bile. Jefferson bought a copy. Following in the tradition of his kinsman John Randolph, the Attorney General, who lived in a beautiful house, Tazewell Hall, on a 99-acre estate on South England Street in Williamsburg, Jefferson was fascinated by gardening. Randolph, a loyalist, owned perhaps the best violin in Virginia. Jefferson long envied it, and had written a book, A Treatise on Gardening by a Citizen of Virginia. The works of Philip Miller, Bernard McMahon, and Thomas Whately also influenced Jefferson's understanding of gardening and landscaping, an understanding centered on the idea of creating and controlling the illusion of wildness and of the natural. In the summer of 1775, his loyalist cousin John Randolph was on Jefferson's mind for reasons other than gardening. Writing to Randolph that August, Jefferson opened pleasantly, expressing regret that Randolph was leaving America for England, and reminding him of his enduring admiration for Randolph's violin. Then Jefferson moved to the real business of the letter, enlisting Randolph as an asset for the American cause. The British, Jefferson believed, were suffering from 2 fundamental misunderstandings of the American position. The first was that the discontent was concentrated within a small faction and was not shared by the broader population. Here Jefferson was shaping reality to suit his purposes. The American movement, while not limited to the elite, was still working its way through the social ranks. The second matter on Jefferson's mind was visceral. They have taken it into their heads, too, that we are cowards, and shall surrender at discretion to an armed force, he said, adding, with a reserved pride, the past and future operations of the war must confirm or undeceive them on that head. In sum, Jefferson wanted Randolph to present the colonists as a broad, united, and brave force that deserved more respect from London. Jefferson was thinking in plain political terms. If America were thought to be divided and cowardly, then the British would have no incentive to negotiate. Weakness in the New World would create contempt in the Old. Jefferson drafted but deleted an interesting threat from the Randolph letter. If Britain were to come to dominate the seaboard colonies militarily, Jefferson mused, there was another option. Perhaps the hardiest of Virginians might move beyond the mountains, which suggested that Jefferson had been party to conversations about an extreme scenario in which the colonists devoted to the American cause might move to the interior of the continent. It is an early example in Jefferson's papers of his envisioning the West as a source of liberty and a theater for reinvention. The specificity of the suggestion in the crisis of 1775 shows that he was thinking hard about the practical implications of rebellion and was open to the most dire of contingencies should things go badly. He did not want to leave Randolph with angry words. That would defeat the purpose of the letter, which was to use his departing kinsman as a conduit to influential people in London. In closing, Jefferson parted on a warm note. "My collection of classics, and of books of parliamentary learning particularly, is not so complete as I could wish. As you are going to the land of literature and of books, you may be willing to dispose of some of yours here and replace them there in better editions. I should be willing to treat on this head with anybody you may think proper to empower for that purpose." The subtext? "We may be political opponents, but we are men of culture who share a love of common things." It was a shrewd touch of Jefferson's. The opening about the violin and the conclusion about the books made the intervening political assessments and assertions appear to be part of a natural conversation. John Randolph read it as such. "Though we may politically differ in sentiments, yet I see no reason why privately we may not cherish the same esteem for each other which formerly, I believe, subsisted between us," Randolph wrote Jefferson on August 31, 1775. "Should any coolness happen between us, I'll take care not to be the first mover of it. We both of us seem to be steering opposite courses. The success of either lies in the womb of time." Jefferson's letter served its purpose, finding its way from John Randolph to William Legg, 2nd Earl of Dartmouth, the British Secretary of State for the colonies. Jefferson had accomplished what he had set out to achieve, present his views to the imperial powers in London. Jefferson spent much of September 1775 at Monticello with his family. The interlude was tragic. His daughter Jane, only a year and a half old, died. After her loss, his letters home, while he was away, were marked by an obsessive concern for Patty and for little Patsy, now his only living child. The demands of his sense of public obligation, however, were great. He left the mountain for the Congress in Philadelphia on Monday, September 25, 1775. Boarding again on Chestnut Street, Jefferson returned to the work of the Congress, but his mind was on Patty and Monticello. He depended on his wife, confiding in her on political matters. He wrote to her, too, of military affairs. Yet for him there was nothing but silence from home in this Philadelphia autumn. She was ill. By Tuesday, October 31, 1775, he was even more worried about Patty. "I have set apart nearly one day in every week since I came here to write letters," he told his friend John Page. "Notwithstanding this, I have never received the scrip of a pen from any mortal breathing." 8 days later, he was more desperate. "I have never received the scrip of a pen from any mortal in Virginia since I left it, nor been able by any enquiries I could make to hear of my family," he wrote a brother-in-law. "The suspense under which I am is too terrible to be endured. If anything has happened, for God's sake, let me know it." Jefferson's anxiety about his personal world extended to the political one as well. There were reports of gathering British strength, cannons en route from the Tower of London, 2,000 troops from Ireland, frigates bound for the Middle Colonies. One target, Virginia. And, more specifically, Virginia planters. The naval forces, Jefferson said, were coming at the express and earnest intercessions of Lord Dunmore, and the plan is to lay waste all the plantations of our riversides. Little seemed cheering. On Sunday, October 22, 1775, an invitation for Jefferson to dine at Roxborough, the country house of the Philadelphia wine merchant Henry Hill, may have promised some shelter from the storms. It was a congenial company, headed by Peyton Randolph, whom Jefferson adored. At Roxborough, around 4 o'clock, Peyton Randolph suffered a stroke. Jefferson called it apoplexy, and lingered about 5 hours, dying at the Hills at 9 o'clock that evening. For Jefferson, the emblem of a whole world, a world Jefferson had known forever and which he aspired to lead, was dead at an hour of great danger. Peyton Randolph had dominated Virginia from the House of Burgesses to the Raleigh Tavern to St. John's Church to the Pennsylvania State House. Jefferson always kept Randolph's example in mind, admiring the blend of conviction and amiability that enabled the man Jefferson called our most worthy speaker to survive and thrive in the arena. Peyton Randolph was dead. Patty Jefferson was sick, and a daughter had died. Jefferson was beset from seemingly every side. Then, in late October 1775, at Hampton, near Norfolk, Virginia, the British tried to land armed parties from British vessels to burn the town. Dunmore was in command of Norfolk, which gave the British a strategic base in a critical point of access. To the north, colonial troops under Benedict Arnold and Richard Montgomery were undertaking expeditions against Canada. And in Virginia, the Virginia Convention, which was governing in the wake of Dunmore's dissolution of the House of Burgesses, created a Committee of Safety, a civilian body, to oversee the state's military. All that Jefferson loved was in peril. The 11 months preceding the Declaration of Independence were a contentious time, in which nothing was certain in his family except Patty's ill health, and in politics except conflict with overwhelming British force. In Philadelphia, Jefferson absorbed account after account, written by his most intimate friends, of the depredations of a superior military force against Virginia. "We care not for our towns, and the destruction of our houses would not cost us a sigh," John Page wrote Jefferson, unconsciously echoing Jefferson's remark to him 5 years earlier, after the Shadwell fire. "I have long since given up mine as lost." Jefferson's political colleagues in the Pennsylvania State House were suffering the same fears over events in their own states. The human element of Jefferson's service in Philadelphia is sometimes minimized, with more attention paid to textual investigations of his resonant state papers. Yet the personal and the philosophical were intimately connected. The Jefferson of the summer of 1776 was shaped by the tensions and contests of 1775. What he read of the deteriorating relations with Dunmore and of the bloodshed and fears in Virginia steeled him for the war ahead. November 7th, 1775, is a forgotten date in the popular memory of the American Revolution, but the events of that autumn, Tuesday, in Virginia, had much to do with those that culminated in the passage of the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia the next year. From his shipboard quarters in Norfolk, Dunmore declared martial law and directly challenged White Virginia, ordering that any slave or indentured servant who took up arms against the American revolutionaries would be granted their freedom. Frightened White Virginians and sympathetic whites in other colonies suddenly saw their most fevered visions of slaves turning against masters threatening to become real. The announcement drove a number of those who had been previously lukewarm about independence into the revolutionary camp. Jefferson thought instantly of his family. If Dunmore succeeded in inspiring an army of slaves and indentured servants, then Monticello might not be safe. Jefferson made plans for Patty and his family to escape in the event of violence, plans that included his joining them in presumably safe territory. "I have written to Patty a proposition to keep yourselves at a distance from the alarms of Lord Dunmore," he wrote a brother-in-law in November. As Jefferson crafted emergency measures for his family, word of Dunmore's strike swept up and down the eastern coast. In late November, John Page was both defiant and pleading. "For God's sake, endeavor to procure us arms and ammunitions," Page wrote Jefferson from Virginia. Page feared the British, and he feared an insurrection of the Negroes. There was something else, too, the sense that the property of Virginia's elites would fall into the hands of the British. "Some rascals, all foreigners, are already looking out for places and handsome seats," Virginia statesman Robert Carter Nicholas wrote Jefferson in late 1775. "No country ever required greater exertions of wisdom than ours does at present," Nicholas wrote Jefferson on November 25th, 1775. "I fear no time is to be lost." As the session of the Congress drew to a close, Jefferson was named to a committee to ascertain unfinished business before Congress. He found 27 separate matters that required attention, from reports on currency and Indian affairs to the making of salt. A second Jefferson task, service on a panel charged with planning the powers of a proposed committee to govern during the congressional recess. It was an instructive exercise, for it required Jefferson to analyze the role the Congress had been playing and discern which functions were essential. In a draft dated December 15, 1775, he listed 19 duties he saw as crucial, ranging from supplying the Continental forces by sea and land to gathering intelligence of the condition and designs of the enemy to ensuring the defense and preservation of forts and strong posts and to prevent the enemy from acquiring new holds. The emphasis on practical military matters was consistent with what had chiefly occupied Jefferson for months. With even his own family in possible danger, he wanted to make it clear that the Americans were ready to exact an eye for an eye. Responding to reports that the American officer Ethan Allen had been captured in the Canadian campaign and was to be sent to Britain in irons to be punished for pretended treasons, Jefferson, in a draft declaration for Congress, said British prisoners would be held accountable for anything that happened to Allen. "We deplore the event which shall oblige us to shed blood for blood, and shall resort to retaliation but as the means of stopping the progress of butchery," he said. But Americans would do what had to be done. In the end, though the Congress deferred any decision to George Washington, the threatening draft shows that Jefferson saw the world as it was. Leaving Philadelphia on Thursday, December 28, 1775, he reached Monticello in the middle of January. It was a new year when he rode up the mountain. There were outward signs of life, as usual. He opened a cask of 1770 Madeira and began to think about taking his wife back with him to Philadelphia to be inoculated against smallpox. But the enveloping crisis could not be kept at bay. On Sunday, February 4, 1776, he was sent a new pamphlet entitled Common Sense. "The cause of America is, in a great measure, the cause of all mankind," wrote Thomas Paine. Jefferson could not have agreed more. Chapter 9. The Course of Human Events. "For God's sake, declare the colonies independent at once and save us from ruin." John Page to Thomas Jefferson, Spring, 1776. "The bells rung all day and almost all night. Even the chimers chimed away." John Adams, describing the reaction to the Declaration of Independence in Philadelphia, 1776. At about 7 o'clock on the morning of Sunday, March 31st, 1776, Jefferson's mother, Jane, 55 years old, was stricken with a stroke and succumbed within an hour. Jefferson asked the Reverend Charles Clay to preside over the funeral. Jane Randolph Jefferson was buried at Monticello. In seeing that his mother was put in ground he held sacred, near others he loved, Jefferson made certain that she would always be part of his home and part of him. Jane's death disoriented her son. Already immersed in the most difficult and fearful of political enterprises, revolution and the creation of a new form of government, Jefferson was brought face to face with one of the deepest personal crises a man can experience. In their parents, children ideally have sources of protection and comfort and love. Parents can also be sources of irritation, fear, and anxiety. Their deaths thus represent both loss and liberation. The mix of the two emotions can be changeable, depending on the hour or the year, but one thing is constant. The parent is gone, which means the child himself, at whatever age, is compelled to assume a measure of the weight of the world commensurate with the passing of time and the increase in responsibility. Though living a crowded and consequential life, Jefferson may have been a lonelier man on the day his mother died than he had ever been. As he turned away from the graveyard, he was not leaving his mother behind. At moments of intense emotional distress, Jefferson often suffered what he would call an attack of my periodical headache, a migraine headache so debilitating and vicious that he once said he was obliged to avoid reading, writing, and almost thinking. Before 1776, his last known bout had come in the wake of his heartbreak over Rebecca Burwell. With the death of Jane Randolph Jefferson, the blood and nerves in his brain gave him nothing but anguish. The force of her death was almost more than he could stand. The pain would not stop. It was a strange time for Jefferson, who lived with the headache, the mourning, and the uncertainty about America's next step. He tried to stay engaged in the life of the plantation, paying a midwife to deliver Elizabeth Hemming's son, John. He tried, too, to stay engaged in life beyond Monticello, collecting money for powder for Virginia and for the relief of the poor of Boston. He left Monticello for Philadelphia on Tuesday, May 7, 1776, arriving 7 days later. Patty stayed in Virginia. "I'm here in the same uneasy, anxious state in which I was the last fall without Mrs. Jefferson, who could not come with me," Jefferson told his fellow Virginia politician, Thomas Nelson, Jr. On May 23rd, he took quarters at a three-story house owned by the bricklayer Jacob Graff, Jr., on the southwest corner of 7th and Market Streets in Philadelphia. He initially felt out of phase with the other delegates. They were speaking of matters he had missed while he had been in mourning at Monticello. But he soon found himself at the center of everything. At the end of the first week of June, 1776, Richard Henry Lee of Virginia moved that the United Colonies were absolved from all allegiance to the British Crown, and that all political connection between them and the state of Great Britain is, and ought to be, totally dissolved. At last, the hour of decision was at hand. The debate over independence began the next day. Congress was not chiefly concerned about the rights of man or even the shape of an American polity. History's trumpets were sounding, but only in the distance. The clatter that dominated the Pennsylvania State House in Philadelphia was about domestic politics and international relations at their most practical. Some representatives argued that a precipitous declaration of independence might provoke some, if not all, of the middle colonies, Pennsylvania, Maryland, Delaware, and New York, to secede from the American cause. If there were such a domestic crack-up, Jefferson reported, foreign powers would either refuse to join themselves to our fortunes, or, having us so much in their power, they would insist on terms proportionately more hard and prejudicial. John Adams, Richard Henry Lee, George Wythe, and others marshaled the evidence in favor of declaring independence. First, they noted that no gentleman had argued against the policy or the right of separation from Britain, nor had supposed it possible we should ever renew our connection, that they had only opposed its being now declared. A compromise was proposed. New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, Delaware, Maryland, and South Carolina were not yet matured for falling from the parent stem, Jefferson said, and it was thought most prudent to wait a while for them. But not too long. A vote was put off 3 weeks, until the 1st of July. In the interim, so that this might occasion as little delay as possible, Jefferson said, committees were appointed to draft a declaration, prepare a plan for the new government, and set guidelines for the negotiation of foreign alliances. But who was best to draft the declaration, which was due for consideration and a vote in fewer than 3 weeks? John Adams thought Jefferson should do it, a decision with roots in a secret conversation that had taken place 2 years before. In 1774, on the eve of the First Continental Congress, Benjamin Rush and a few other delegates had met the Massachusetts contingent on the outskirts of Philadelphia. Taking tea in a private room at an inn in Frankfort, Pennsylvania, 6 miles from the city, Rush and his colleagues offered Adams and company some practical political counsel. "We were all suspected of having independence in view," Adams recalled long afterward, "and Massachusetts seemed ahead of much of the rest of America." Adams continued. "Now," said they, "you must not utter the word independence, nor give the least hint or insinuation of the idea, neither in Congress or any private conversation. If you do, you are undone. For the idea of independence is as unpopular in Pennsylvania and in all the middle and southern states as the Stamp Act itself. No man dares to speak of it. Moreover, you are the representatives of the suffering state. Boston and Massachusetts are under a rod of iron. British fleets and armies are tyrannizing over you. You yourselves are personally obnoxious to them and all the friends of government. You have been long persecuted by them all. Your feelings have been hurt, your passions excited. You are thought to be too warm, too zealous, too sanguine. You must be, therefore, very cautious. You must not come forward with any bold measures. You must not pretend to take the lead. You know Virginia is the most populous state in the Union. They are very proud of their ancient dominion, they call it. They think they have a right to take the lead, and the southern states, and middle states, too, are too much disposed to yield it to them. Adams appreciated the straight talk. This was plain dealing, and I must confess that there appeared so much wisdom and good sense in it that it made a deep impression on my mind, and it had an equal effect on all my colleagues, he recalled. 2 years later, meeting with Jefferson in the early summer of 1776, Adams had what he called the Frankfort advice, the town was actually Frankford, in mind. To a correspondent who wondered why Jefferson had been invested with such responsibility, Adams wrote, "You inquire why so young a man as Mr. Jefferson was placed at the head of the committee for preparing a Declaration of Independence? I answer, it was the Frankfort advice, to place Virginia at the head of everything. There were three committees appointed at the same time, one for the Declaration of Independence, another for preparing Articles of Confederation, and another for preparing a treaty to be proposed to France. Mr. Lee was chosen for the Committee of Confederation, and it was not thought convenient that the same person should be upon both. Mr. Jefferson came into Congress in June 1775, and brought with him a reputation for literature, science, and a happy talent of composition. Writings of his were handed about, remarkable for the peculiar felicity of expression. Though a silent member in Congress, he was so prompt, frank, explicit, and decisive upon committees and in conversation, not even Samuel Adams was more so, that he soon seized upon my heart, and upon this occasion I gave him my vote and did all in my power to procure the votes of others. I think he had one more vote than any other, and that placed him at the head of the committee. I had the next highest number, and that placed me the second. The committee met, discussed the subject, and then appointed Mr. Jefferson and me to make the draft. I suppose because we were the two first on the list." As Adams recalled the ensuing conversation with Jefferson, the Virginian suggested that Adams himself write the draft. "I will not," Adams said. "You should do it," Jefferson said. "Oh, no." "Why will you not? You ought to do it.